Hello, I'm Tom Clark.
And I'm Allegra Stratton.
And this is Politics Weekly.
On today's show, the government promises a better Britain, but does it have the money to finance it?
Telling porkies in Parliament. Should politicians be told to their face when we think they're lying?
And finally, new licences for teachers. Will they all pass the test?
And in the pod, we have two of The Guardian's finest analytical minds, Polly Toynbee and Jonathan Friedland.
I want to know which politicians had their brain most addled by the heat this week.
I'm afraid I think it has to be Gordon Brown. Or at least he assumes everybody else's brain is addled. He really seems able to think, as he was saying to the BBC, that he's behaving like an opposition politician, saying, I can find magic up huge sums of money from bureaucracy, wastage, some programmes unspecified in order to pay for all these plans. And, I mean, nobody believes that. Nobody could believe it. Either he's been running such a lax ship that he's got loads of money swishing about doing nothing, which isn't actually true, or he's just lying. And the worst of it is, you know, I'm afraid, as Cameron keeps saying, does he take us for fools?
I mean, I would have... The Brown example I would have lighted upon was his answer in Question Time of saying, no, spending is going up every year. And his first example was, we're increasing spending by 0% in the year 2011 to 13 or something. I mean, that he does walk into these giant traps. I mean, if that had been, we're increasing spending by 1.1%, then 0.7%, and then 0%, you could see how he could have got to that. But it was the first number he picked out as an example of an increase was 0%, and he does that very often.
What about Mandelson being jostled? Is that another kind of sign of heat stroke? Jostled out of the parliamentary programme?
Oh, I actually thought that was very clever and a very elegant word.
You know,
euphemistic, Whitehall, sort of Mandarinese. You know, we're not being dropped, you're just being jostled for time.
Except it was dropped 2 days later.
Of course, but you knew that's what he meant. It was just a very silky and elegant way of putting it.
Gordon Brown this week attempted to revive political fortunes with a new agenda for government. It's called Building Britain's Future, and it's about giving power to people, or at least that's what it says on the tin. It did, however, look very much like an election manifesto, and there's quite a lot of spending commitments within it. We asked Larry Elliott, our economics editor, whether he thinks Gordon can pay for it.
The position we have with the public finances is that they are in a pretty rotten state. They were in a rotten state before the recession started, and they're obviously in an even worse state now. The government thinks we will borrow something like £175 billion in the current financial year and pretty much the same in the next financial year. So really, there's not an awful lot of money there in the kitty for Gordon Brown to play with. How that relates to what was announced this week in Building Britain's Future is that he doesn't have any extra money to spend on the things that the government now wants to make a priority of, such as council housing. So he's had to go round Whitehall effectively robbing other departments of any surplus cash they might have had left at the end of the financial year. So he's picked up a bit of money from the Home Office, he's picked up a bit of money from the Education Department and a bit of money from the Transport Department that they hadn't spent. And he's reallocated that to council housing around £1.5 billion over 2 years. The political context of this really is that Labour would like to go into the next election as it has into the previous two elections, portraying themselves as the party of investment and growth and the Conservatives as the party of austerity and cuts. The Conservatives are saying that this is all smoke and mirrors, that there really is no money to be had, and that after the election, no matter who's in power, there is going to have to be a fundamental look at public spending. And there is some truth in that. It's quite true that the state of the public finances is so bad that whoever wins the next election is facing some pretty tough choices, and I don't think anybody in either party would dispute that.
Polly, you're looking very glum. You gave Building Britain's Future a very positive write-up. Why?
Well, I think there are aspects of it that are very good. I mean, it's kind of weird ragbag because they did just pass the hat around Whitehall. Has anybody got any spare ideas going? Anybody got anything that might vaguely go into this document? But the bits that I liked about it were the idea of nailing down future spending by giving rights, absolute rights. It's, you know, one thing to say we're going to do away with central targets. But it's very powerful to give people a right to a minimum wage in the NHS if you've got cancer or if you're waiting for a hip. It hammers in the spending for the future. I can't see the Tories daring to go back to Parliament saying, actually, we're going to rescind those rights, which they would now have to do by law. So the money will have to be spent. I think Labour should go around nailing down a whole lot more things. I think they should nail the minimum wage to annual earnings levels and things of that kind in order to commit the future government to decent spending on the things that really matter, on Labour priorities. But at some point or another, Labour's going to say how they themselves would pay for it. And I think that means it has to include tax rises. I think, you know, a national insurance rise again to pay for the health service and to pay for that right would be politically possible. I think you could say to people, it's tough times, NHS is your priority, it's ours too, we're going to put up at least national insurance to pay for it.
But Johnny, I mean, they've got their back against the wall, and as Polly says, they seem to have come up with something with a little bit of intellectual credibility. I mean, it's an actual sort of philosophical shift, turning from targets to entitlements.
Yes, I mean, the sceptical view is that it's just saying the same thing again in different language from the other end of the telescope, if you like. So before it was the hospital that was required by a target to make sure the wait was 2 weeks. Now you as a patient can expect it to be 2 weeks. Then all the questions come of enforcement. How exactly would this be enforced? Are you going to have thousands of patients taking individual or class action lawsuits because the hospital didn't give them the operation until 2 weeks and 1 day? I mean, it is, you know, you can see the technical problems with it, but the political principle, I think, that Polly identifies is right, which is that you make it harder. I don't think necessarily impossible, but you make it harder for a future government, because it isn't just that you announce a budget which was different from the Labour government's budget. You actually have to repeal a law which people will have liked, you know, that patients have the right to this or that care. So that's so the politics of it are good, even if technically it's either very difficult to enforce or actually the same thing, just dressed up a different way.
I mean, it does seem that over the course of the week, as they've been pushed on this question of how you enforce it, Polly, that they've shifted their ground, because at first they were terrified of this idea, it's going to be litigation culture. And then gradually it kind of became clear there was going to be this system of ombudsman, and then in the end kind of fall back on judicial review. So maybe it will have some real bite.
I doubt if it'll get to that very often, because it just isn't actually the way the health service in the real world works.
If you missed a 2 week waiting time.
Exactly, you missed 2 weeks. It's going to take you more than 2 weeks to get to judicial review, that's for sure. If you've got cancer, you're in trouble. I think the way it works is that people use their GPs as their agent, and the GP will be the person to say, I will get you an appointment within 2 weeks, and if not, he's the one to make a fuss. And they've always been the gatekeepers and the advocate for the patient, and that's how it's worked under the previous system, which has worked very well. After all, 96% of people are seen within the cancer 2 weeks. You know, 95% or so are seen within the 18
weeks.
It's not a
problem. It's not a position of sort of saying end of target culture, but targets worked.
It did work. They did work. And it would be insane to remove them. And the fact that they've put them in as a patient right makes it inalienable or very difficult for a future government. It doesn't change the nature of the target. And of course, targets worked, and nowhere more clearly than in the health service, or a bit of gaming around the edges, a bit of parking people in so-called wards in order to hit an A&E 4-hour wait. But I mean, that's minimal compared to the extraordinary change in how people are actually treated.
It's the sort of thing that if it had come at the first flower of a Labour government in the first couple of years, we'd have hailed it as actually an inspired and brilliant move, because targets had a sense of micromanaging, of Whitehall tying the hands of NHS managers. Doctors should decide, but now some dictator said, you've got to do this by the X weeks. By framing it as a patient having a right to walk into hospital and say, I need this treatment, we'd have viewed targets completely differently if they'd been framed this way. It's just 12 years in, they've hit on the right language and the right device for what remains the same idea. It's only because it's a fag-end tired government that in a way people do immediately want to say Cohen's hotline, last gasp, this is an early manifesto. Actually, it's a way of turning what was a very core Blair idea, but never really fully communicated, it had a lot of very negative baggage, into really something quite positive that voters can embrace.
I'm struck by the fact that there was, this week, we've seen, not only in Building Britain's Future, extra money for council housing. We've also seen the ditching of ID cards, or the compulsory element of ID cards. We've seen the partial renationalisation of the railway in the last day or two, and then the cancellation of the privatisation of Royal Mail. Now, these are all things which, in a different climate, The Guardian and most Labour supporters would be saying, this is good stuff, we're back to a real Labour government. And we're not, are we? Because the choreography is so awful. Everyone's saying the whole thing's a chaos.
Yes, and that's not just because it's fag end. That's because of how the government comes to these decisions. They come to them by in reverse. They sort of back into these positions reluctantly. and they keep doing this. I mean, in the end, the Iraq inquiry will be in public. But no one's going to give them credit for that because they didn't want it. They wanted it in private. In the end, we'll find out all about the expenses. They'll get no credit because they put them out with all the censored, blacked out bits. They keep doing this so that reluctantly and in the and with gritted teeth, they end up doing the right thing. And you want to sort of grab Gordon Brown by the lapels and say you could get credit for these things if you only did them first and you didn't wait to be pushed. It turns out that what happened in that Gurkha vote, you first of all adopt an untenable position, you get humiliated and defeated in public, and then you do the right thing. That's become the template for Gordon Brown's government. That's how he operates.
The trouble is, having started with the wrong things in the first place, you know, if you hate ID cards, if you hate the idea of privatisation of the Royal Mail, you know, these are all Labour initiatives. They're not things that just arrived out of the blue. And I think that's a real problem. When Labour goes into opposition, it's going to be a real problem of contamination of everybody who's in the cabinet now is contaminated with those policies. And when the Tories, if they probably will privatise considerably more of the Royal Mail, it will leave anybody who was in that cabinet absolutely struck dumb or looking ridiculous.
But this makes you realise the opportunity that Brown blew, really, because he could have done all of this. He could have made his agenda, and it's a ridiculously negative way of putting it, but undoing the excesses of Blairism would have been fine. For Gordon Brown, he could have said all the different things: ID cards, Trident, privatisation,
Iraq review.
Brown could have set about, in some ways, as Major did with Thatcher, just reining in, tempering, undoing the worst excesses of the previous period. But he never really could make his mind up to do that. I mean, this was the perennial question: was he the continuity guy or the change guy? Now, reluctantly and under pressure, he's become the change guy. But it's too late.
But that's because if anybody whispered to him, "Oh, you're abandoning the public sector reform agenda," he completely panicked and did something horrible to show that he was a true Blairite.
A moderniser.
Both agreed that there's been a mismanagement on about four or five policy elements this week. But are they, this debate about cuts, and there seems to be the division between the Brown Balls lot and then the Liam Byrne, even Hilary Benn suggesting that his department at some point will have to have a reduced pot of money. Don't they have to get onto, it's a crass way of putting it, but nice cuts versus nasty cuts? They will be cutting,
absolutely.
It's just they'll do it like this.
You put it very well, absolutely. I mean, nobody is going to be completely honest, never are. You know, the idea that either manifesto is going to look like an effective budget, even budgets aren't that honest in lots of ways. It just needs a few credible things to say, sorry, we're going to have to cut X or Y in order to pay for such and such. Or here are our priorities, which they began to do in this paper. Here are our priorities of what we really want a ring fence, and it should include Sure Start as well as NHS and international aid and so on. What are your priorities? We're going to pay for our priorities by, well, it might be a windfall tax. And we forget Gordon Brown did a $5 billion windfall tax in 97. Something of that kind. It might not actually cover the cost, but at least it's something to say. It's something convincing. It's some kind of cost or raising, cut or raising money. At the moment, most of the cabinet feel they don't want to get up there and tell a lie.
Well, I'm pleased you said that, Polly, because that brings us on to our next topic. We might not expect total honesty in the public finances, but the L word of politics is causing trouble again now, with Gordon Brown being accused of lying about the government's bank balance. And in turn, Labour has accused Shadow Chancellor George Osborne of peddling his own porkies by claiming he couldn't get access to the Treasury's books. Michael White considers how politicians dance around deception.
White Noise with Michael White.
Not being a regular reader of righteous Tory pundits with short selective memories, I missed the latest excitement as to whether or not Gordon Brown tells lies. It was triggered by David Cameron's remark on Monday that, I quote, there is a thread of dishonesty running through his premiership. The thought arose in the context of Brown's upbeat presentation of public spending projections during the recession and his claim, successfully promoted through three general elections, that voters' choice is always between Labour investment and those wicked Tory cuts. In the Mail, Sun and Spectator, Cameron's words prompted teenage scribblers, some of them pretty casual with their own facts, to make fresh demands that the Tory leader or a surrogate call GB a liar to his face. Wiser, the Economist wondered if that course might backfire as a bit of public school bullying, which indeed it might, though Peter Mandelson slammed the ball back across the net yesterday by accusing George Osborne of deliberate deception over those public spending figures. In my experience, some politicians are shifty in private, or rather less so in the open air. You learn not to trust them any more than you do those teenage scribblers. Rather more MPs, Tony Blair was a good example here, believe whatever it is they're saying at the time. First he deceived himself and then he deceived the voters, as Douglas Hurd once put it about Iraq, though Hurd could do that trick too, over Bosnia. I distinguish here between lies and not telling the whole truth, withholding facts. In war and other crises, leaders sometimes have to sound more optimistic than they feel to be economical with the actualité. In 1967, for instance, as Labour ministers were finally discussing devaluing sterling, then-Chancellor Jim Callaghan was less than frank with MPs at question time. That's fine by me, occasionally it's the only option people understand. So, does a thread of Porky's disfigure the Brown career, as Cameron suggests? I rather fear it does. Yes, there's also an element of denial, another word people use about him, in Brown's makeup. He doesn't like being challenged. He doesn't do criticism well. He also sometimes fluffs words under pressure, as he did at PMQs yesterday. Quite different from Blair's Pollyanna-ish optimism, often silly, always lucid, always sunny. But Brown's high-minded ambition, also real in its way, is dogged by a nagging, nail-biting insecurity which takes him to dark places. I think voters instinctively know this, so Cameron doesn't have to say it out loud. It demeans politics. What's more, he'd be paid back. Stick to the traditional euphemism, Dave. How did Churchill put it? Terminological inexactitude.
I think we're teenage scribblers, Tom. I've been so struck this week. The worst example was Les Cameron saying thread of deception or thread of dishonesty or whatever, and then Mandelson on Wednesday coming back. But the right-wing publication that Mike's talking about is The Spectator, and Fraser Nelson, he listened to Ed Balls on the radio and he said basically he's telling a lie, and he called him a liar. And Ed picked up the phone and rang and rang and rang and said, take that blog post down, this is outrageous. And so they had it. But the discussion turns on, to be able to call someone a liar, you have to be able to know that they deliberately misled. But Fraser said he had the facts to indicate that, you know, Ed was telling an untruth about you. But people have been saying you cannot call people a liar. It coarsens political debate. And I just find it so interesting. If in political debate you can't call someone what they are, then what's the point of political debate? Do you think you can or can't use the word liar, Polly?
I think it probably doesn't help because it's kind of nuclear. And once you've said that, there's nothing more to say. I thought Mike White got it absolutely right, that there are so many different layers of self-deception, delusion, avoidance, evasion, what's legal and not, rather like tax avoidance, tax evasion. You cannot tell the truth if you are a minister all the time, the whole truth. Mm. You can't possibly, and you shouldn't. And you shouldn't necessarily be expected to. You should avoid the outright lie direct. But I think it's tricky. People all think all politicians lie all the time. I think they struggle not to. Yeah. But the whole truth is just not what politics can do.
Somebody said this week, you shouldn't use the word liar in political debate, full stop.
I think I would be against using it. I think I would.
But you know, when the speaker has just changed, obviously, and people talk about this old gentleman's club, and one of the rules is that you have to come up with phrases like terminological inexactitude or whatever it isn't one of the problems that people don't use the language that the rest of the country does when it talks about politicians? If you think about Iraq or something, maybe you need to keep it for special occasions, but on those special occasions, shouldn't you pull out?
But if you use the language the rest of the world does, you get down to the equivalent of our blog posters, and it's just yaboo and vile poison all the time. Do we really want the Commons to descend to that? There's not much way back once you sink to the very bottom of hurling abuse at each other. It makes any subtlety of point even harder. I mean, it's very difficult now for someone to say, look, this is a difficult question. It's finely balanced judgment. Here are the arguments in favour, here against, and on balance, we're in favour. It's difficult enough to say that, but I think in the noise of people hurling any old abuse at each other, it would be impossible.
Johnny, you've been doing lots of throat clearing.
No, I think it's an interesting one, because even putting aside for a second the morality of it, the problem with hurling that accusation is I think it damages you, the hurler, as much as the hurlee. I mean, in other words, you know, people forget the detail. All they remember is that you calling somebody a liar somehow sinks you into that pit, and what people then think is all politicians lie, etc. So I think it's one of those weapons that damages the person who wields it just as much as who it's aimed at. I also think it's one of these funny examples where people hold politicians to a standard they do not themselves follow. I mean, you were saying that everyone would use that word in ordinary life. And yet, actually, yeah, the minute anybody has any responsibility, the most minor thing, I mean, you know, the school PTA is not, and they know some incident happened at the school fair, you're not going to write a letter to parents spelling out exactly what happened. Mm. There'll be some euphemism for it. There's the same thing will go on in corporate life where, you know, everyone will put the best possible gloss on this year's results, even though everyone in the office knows that actually, you know, the so-and-so in accounts is a dud. You know, that's how things work. And it's false, actually, to assume that somehow politics is the only realm of life where people don't withhold the facts, put the best gloss on them, etc.
But the leader of the opposition, the shadow chancellor, the first minister, Lord Mandelson, they've all decided that it's a potent level of debate. They're all using this language of untruth, dishonesty. They're not saying liar.
Well, I was fascinated by the Mandelson intervention of all of them for a couple of reasons. First of all, it makes me think that he really does have a grudge against Osborne for reasons we know about, going back to the Oleg Deripaska affair. And there's a history there. Also, it just struck me, the reaction to it, that he inspires fear still in the other side in a way that I don't think Brown does. The sense that if you cross Mandelson, he's an enemy who can wreak havoc against you, still exists. And I think Brown has lost the ability to make people fear him. He used to have it, actually, as a Commons operator. He really did have it.
Mind you, Osborne.
I don't think he has that anymore.
Osborne had crossed a line in suggesting that the Prime Minister had personally interfered in what is a civil service matter. It's entirely up to the civil servants to deliver the right amount of information to the opposition. It's a tradition. And the idea, A, that the Prime Minister would step in and do that, and B, that the civil service would cave in, was a, you know, he himself had crossed a bad line in that accusation. Mm. And I haven't seen Osborne retract it.
George Osborne may have crossed the line, but we're going to draw a line under that discussion at that point. Allegra.
The other thing that happened this week was that Ed Balls set out new education plans. Teachers are going to need a new licence to teach if they want to work in a state school. If they aren't good enough, they will be ejected from the English education system. Tom, you were locked in a room with Ed Balls, or not with Ed Balls, and given a briefing with Ed, right? And tell us what he said.
Well, there were, as you say, very many bits to this education announcement, a bit like the Building Britain's Future in miniature. Instead of taking the cart round Whitehall to people to put things in, they took it round the education department. The most eye-catching thing, as you allude to, is kind of MOTs for teachers. Not necessarily a bad idea if the quid pro quo for that, I think, is getting rid of some of the performance and monitoring stuff that's so burdensome. Second big idea was report cards, where instead of just the narrow focus on shoving kids who are at the exam borderline just over the pass mark, the idea is you'd look at average exam marks right across the board, and also other things like music and sport and so on. And then thirdly, there was this big emphasis on schools working together, cooperating both with social services for disadvantaged kids and also cooperating with each other to raise standards. Not sure how many schools will want to do that. But what really struck me listening to it is there is now, even if there's going to be kind of tight times on the money front ahead under either government, there is an emerging divide between the parties on whether or not we should think of each school as an island, which is a law unto itself, because the Conservatives' proposal here is very much that there should be more free schools. Where they get the money from that, I'm not sure. But and then they're left to their own devices. Whereas with under Ed Balls and Gordon Brown, it seemed like the emphasis is much more on schools cooperating together in the school system rather than individual schools. I don't know, Johnny, do you think that's an interesting dividing line opening up?
I don't know whether that'll be enough, actually, whether that captures the imagination quite as an issue. I think you're right to identify it as the difference. I thought this licence thing is interesting. That will appeal to some parents, I could imagine. But then it goes similar, actually, to the thing we were talking about with the health guarantee. How exactly do you enforce that? I mean, the issue has been until now that teachers, underperforming teachers, are very hard to sack.
They move schools.
And they move schools. But even, actually, even if within the same school, there's a whole... The disciplinary code is unbelievably detailed, what you've actually got to get people on, and then even if there's a complaint, then there has to be a second complaint and a second warning, and unions are involved. It's a very elaborate procedure. And so what I thought when I looked at this was, how will this be any different? I mean, if a head teacher tries to revoke the license of a teacher, won't that teacher then say, no, I want a warning, and then a second warning, and rightly, the union will have to be involved, and it will become just as bureaucratic. Mm-hmm. So I just wondered if actually it's a new label on the same problem and therefore perhaps won't solve the problem.
Well, they're treading very gently indeed. It was remarkable how they managed to get the NAS and the teaching unions come out and support it by linking it all to professional development. But if you look at how they're proposing to start to phase this thing in, they're going to start with supply teachers where they think there's often more of a problem, and they're going to start with returning teachers who've been out of the profession and then new teachers. So the idea is that you bring it in steps, so you don't have to force some great culture clash with the unions and the profession, but you phase it in very, very gradually, I think, Polly. I mean, do you think it's a good idea to make it into a licensed profession?
I think it is. I think anything that gives head teachers a little bit more, another implement with which to try to winkle out their bad teachers, they know who they are, they're mostly quite scared of them. They're very often the bad teachers, the ones who become the shop stewards, because they're then unremovable. And they've been there a very long time, quite often. And so I think it is another bit in the toolkit, but Johnny says it's, if you're a head teacher who's lost the nerve to do it anyway, I don't know if this will suddenly empower you, perhaps as it should, because after all we now have a whole new cadre of teachers coming in of infinitely higher quality than, you know, the ones who came in 20 years ago. And they really are, they're measurably, the degrees they've got, the fact that it's become a very highly favoured, before the recession, a highly favoured occupation, whereas it was 50th on the list for graduates. It's better paid, better prospects, you can move up the system much faster if you're really good. Teach First has been a very good programme for getting in bright students. So you do really quite want to get rid of your, you know, coasting teachers if you think you've got a whole lot of really bright ones you could put them in instead. But I'm very doubtful about the political argument about the mechanics of who runs schools. Mm. I think Labour has wasted vast amount of time and money, both in the health service and in education, obsessing about the structures.
It wasn't the next development. You didn't see it as a sort of happy marriage of, dare I say it, Blairites and Brownites.
I mean, let's think what they've done. You know, there've been academies, foundations, trusts, faith schools hugely grown, number of grammar specialist schools, number of grammar school places hugely increased. All of these are pressures on total independence. There's been nothing but abuse of local authorities. Some local authorities have been privatised. There's been no sense of let's all work together collaboratively here. It's left all sorts of oddities as to who's supposed to deal with special needs kids, who's supposed to deal with expelled kids and that kind of thing. And I think the public is deeply bored with all of that. Mm. I think, of course, collaboration is a much better way to go, but it runs counter to everything Labour's done. So they've wasted a lot of money on it.
The third of schools that are failing kids, trying to get them A to Cs, will yesterday's announcement do anything, or is it tinkering?
Well, by addressing the teacher, quality of teaching issue, which this licence is about, he's aiming in the right direction with that.
But is that issue number one or number four or what?
Well, that's one of the drawbacks of producing a kind of, you know, rag bag or, you know, collection of items like this, is you don't get that sense of priority. I think this, you know, at least locating the focus on the teacher and teaching what goes on in the classroom is always seemed to me to be the most important thing, that the structural discussion was in some ways a diversion from that. There are important aspects of that, because if every school is an island, then what exactly does happen with even just transport of kids around an area and the special needs case is more obvious. But politics is about, partly just in communication terms, it is about deciding on a single priority and making that clear. And that's the problem both with the Building Britain's Future and the education thing, is so many proposals in there, it's hard for people to get their head around it. And at this late stage, when people are barely listening to the government, you really have to have a single clear thing to say. Quality of teachers is quite a good point. My worry is that the licence thing sounds like another scheme and another structure, in a way. More labelling and bureaucracy, rather than actually just improving them, which is what people are desperate for. And this is one of the things that you heard from what Polly was saying about the status in the profession, how it's changed over 12 years. That message has in some ways been drowned out. Labour haven't got that message out over the years because it's been all these big rows about structural and funding issues. And I think this is going to be one of the things that happens after the Labour government are gone. the retrospective will suddenly be, actually, there were quite a lot of very good things that happened that we barely noticed, partly because they didn't put them up in lights and because they were drowned out by all these other ideological battles that they didn't need to have. The change in status of education, of teaching, is one of those huge cultural changes that has happened under our noses without us even really noticing.
Okay, that's it for today. Thanks to Polly Toynbee and Jonathan Friedland for gracing our pod.
Remember to visit the Politics blog for breaking political news, analysis, commentary, and more importantly, to put your own ideas.
Politics Weekly was produced by Francesca Panetta. I'm Tom Clark.
I'm Allegra Stratton. Until next week, goodbye.